It's going to be a fun ride. Having been in and out of school for far too long, it's always that new anticipation, that new semester, the class, where everything is exciting for at least the first 2 weeks. Before you miss your first assignment, don't do homework, and get back feed. It's those moments that you're like, yes, this is going to be the one that's different. So if that's what you're feeling with this series, you're like, I'm going to be for everyone. I'll take notes. I'll do exactly what I'm inspired to do. Congratulations. But it also gives us a chance to step into a wild story, because we're going to be stepping into the story of Exodus. We title it God in Search of Humanity, the story of Exodus, largely because often, at least I can say for myself, we think God's someone who we have to get God's attention, almost an absentee person who doesn't really care if you're around, but maybe if I yell loud enough, if I say enough prayers, if I memorize enough text, God might condescend to be around. But in God's search for humanity, it's stating God wants to. Sometimes needs reminding, according to Exodus, but God desires and wants to interact, to be a part of life. So we're going to begin the new journey through Exodus, and today we're going to do an overview of the series just to set the stage for where we're going, because we're trying to be intentional with what we present. We're going to look at the big picture of Exodus, because we're staying in the book for the whole series, so having the big picture in your mind is something that can help you engage and interact. And then we're going to camp in Exodus 2:23-3:10. So without getting too technical, I'm going to have Sheldon help me with this one. That amused me so much to do. And we're going to talk about the four lenses we typically step into Scripture with. Now, the first lens is called Christological. Yes, see, he's on track. And within the Christological lens, it's typically what we do where we read stories, and it comes from the term Christos, or Messiah, the last name of Jesus, and you look at it and say, where do I find Jesus? So when you see things like in Corinthians with Paul, where he says, and did you know Jesus was the rock that followed people through Exodus? He wasn't. He was reading into the text. No one ever thought that Jesus was a rock. But that's a Christological reading, because Paul's saying, do you not see that Jesus has been with us the whole time? The second way we step into it is the ecclesiological. Now, our German friends, the term church comes from them. It was carried over into English because King James kept it as part of the institutional language. However, it comes from the term ecclesia, or the called out ones, which just meant us, the community. So when we do ecclesiological readings, you're doing a lot like 1 Peter, where it says, you are a royal priesthood. You are a chosen nation, a blessed people. You can be read into the story. And it's about us finding our place within the text. So when we read and we step into Old Testament passages, and we get to say, what does it mean because of Christ? Who are we? What is the community? That's typically where we speak from here. The third one is the one we're taught to do in seminary, the historical, critical, grammatical approach. Most of you would hate it, because unless you want to read 40 pages on the moving of a comma, which Richard Hayes actually wrote about Romans chapter 3, I read 20 pages on, I think that shouldn't have been a comma, it should be a semicolon. I did not know I wasn't nerd enough for a book until I read that one. I went, I get it, punctuation. Please move on. But that's what this is about. The questions you're going to ask in the historical critical. In Exodus, when I spoke on chapter 18, what I didn't address because we weren't doing historical, Exodus 18 actually should happen after the events of the Mount of God. However, for the narrative structure, they put it in 18 before the people have arrived to the mountain, which should cause a weird question. How does Jethro come to a camped people who haven't arrived at their camp yet? But that's a historical question. Or if we're saying, who do we think wrote Exodus? To what people? Was it the people already in Israel? Was it the people in Egypt? Was it Moses while he was building a tent, walking with fire pillars and smoke, going, huh, I should keep a memoir? Those are the historical questions. But that's not what we're dealing with, because this one we're going to be intentional. So we're going to do a literary lens for this series. And within the literary lens, we lean in a little bit to the text, finding the story's structure. So our specific lens for this series isn't going to be one that we answer historical questions. We're not even going to be asking ecclesiological questions. We're not going to say, well, do you see in chapter 5, therefore we? And we're not trying to find Christ. Not because Christ is not important, but because we want to sit in the story of Exodus. And Exodus was a long time before Jesus, at least as a physical person. And we're doing this for one very specific intentional reason as a community. Our hope is the close reading of Exodus will help us understand the hope coming in Advent, which the Gospels describe, mainly the Synoptic, so Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all describe Jesus as the new Exodus. So in order to step into that hope, the Advent season, in order for us to hear with fresh ears, we're going to more intentionally stay in the book of Exodus and try not to project to the future when the Christ has come, not move completely to the present to say, well, we can see in verse 1, therefore we. We're going to listen to the voice of Exodus. And we can get challenged in that so we can have a future hope as well. So from there, that's where the series is going. You're going to sit in Exodus so we can see to Advent, and in Advent we can celebrate the new Exodus. But first, we need the flow of Exodus. So Exodus is the story of God hearing Israel's cry and seeking out Israel in order to turn a people into a nation. It's not a story of slavery to freedom as we often tell it, simply because the term for slave is eved, in that it's the same term used for who they're going to be towards God. So it's not a matter of saying we're now enslaved, now we're free, we do what we want. It's actually saying we were servants and slaves to Pharaoh. Now we've had a more gracious, benevolent, kind king in God, and God demands us not to make bricks but to rest, which is a huge movement because Pharaoh, every time he came in against pushback, he said, more bricks, more quota, I'll take away from you. In the story of Exodus, it's the story of a God who says, no, I am king, therefore I demand you rest. He goes as far as to say, none of your slaves, none of your people, none of your children, not even your animals can work, because there'll be a day of the week that you just sit with me. And it's the story of kingships traveling. So the narrative moves through two trips to the Mount of God. The first one is Moses by himself. He goes out, he's walking with animals, boom, there's a bush. The second one, he goes back to Egypt and moves the whole people. But it's just those two trips. The entire book is two journeys. So chapter 1 is setting the stage. A free people become state-owned slaves. The state says you're getting too big, so if we beat you, you won't rebel. That seems counterintuitive to me, but it works for Pharaoh. Chapter 2 through 4, you get a time lapse, a burning bush, and the call of an agent for liberation, which is a beautiful piece. We're going to be camping in chapters 2 to 4 today because it's the call of the agent. 5 through 18 is, this is going to be a good term for you. It's usually used in creation accounts, but today we can use it in a creation of a nation. Theomache, the war of the gods. It's fun. And so the war of the Jewish gods come against the war against the Egyptian gods. The Egyptian loses, and we march onto a mountain. And then 19 through 40, think of it, 21 chapters. We've went through 80 years, battle of the gods, seas parting, pillars of fire, and says, you know where we're going to camp? Let's build a tent. We're going to spend 21 chapters telling you how to build a tent. Because it ends in the Decalogue and God inhabiting the community. It ends with the God saying, everything I've done is so I can spend this moment leaning into you, sitting with you as a people. Because just as the royal palace sits in the center of the city that everyone looks at, the new king of Israel sits in the center of the community in a place you can see. And that is the thrust and the hope of Exodus. So we're going to sit in the second section where God is affected by a cry of pain. Not a prayer of piety to move towards Israel. So, we're going to go to chapter 2, verse 23, and read to 10. A long time after that, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites were groaning under bondage and cried out, and their cry for help from the bondage rose up to God. God heard their moaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them. Now Moses, tending the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, drove the flock into the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. An angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire out of a bush. He gazed over, and there was a bush all aflame, yet the bush was not consumed. Moses said, I must turn aside to look at this marvelous sight. Why doesn't it burn up? When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God called out of the bush, Moses, Moses. He answered, Here I am. And God said, Do not come closer. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. The Lord continued, I have marked well the plight of my people in Egypt, have heeded their outcry because of their taskmasters. Yes, I am mindful of their suffering. I have come down to rescue them from the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land to a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the region of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. Moreover, I have seen how the Egyptians have oppressed them. Come, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh. You shall free my people, the Israelites, from Egypt. Awesome story. We're going to now sit into the notes of the text. Now, if you notice, the abuse started in chapter 1, verses 13 to 14. Where the Egyptians noted the large amount of successful birth rates with the Israelites and said, this is no good. And so the Egyptians ruthlessly imposed upon the Israelites various labors that they made them perform. Ruthlessly, they made life bitter for them with harsh labor at mortar and bricks, with all sorts of tasks in the field. For where we're coming to our section, there's an undisclosed amount of time passing from the cries of the people reaching God in the heavenly court. Verse 23 says, a long time after, a cry for help rose up to God. See, the cry isn't directed at God. There's no object, there's no to. It's not, I cried out to. It's not like, I called you and said, could you come save me? It's more like the scene in the movie to where the loved one dies of your main protagonist, and you see them fall to their knees weeping, just yelling in anguish. It was a people's cry. However, in 24 to 25, God heard, God remembered, God investigates, and God knew them. The reason why the knew them is important, because in chapter 1, verse 8, it said, a king arose who did not know Joseph. It uses the same verb for knowing to say when God searched, he knew them, which is another way to say he recognized, he saw them. These actions of King God mirroring Pharaoh, one moves to become an overlord and take control and power. The other one moves to rescue. Cries go up to Pharaoh and becomes more ruthless. Cries come up to God. And God comes down from heaven, because the way they're seeing is a tiered system. The divine realm's up here in a royal court in a holy city. The king left the royal court to come to the people, where what you see with every time of Pharaoh, the people have to go to the royal court and plead to a king. So why is this unique? Like, we've heard the story a few times. We've been around church for a length of time. We do like Exodus. So we may lose the nuancing of why this is a unique tale. As John Goldengay says, Yahweh may be sovereign, but it is not simply God's sovereignty that initiates events in the world. God waits upon the cries of the people. In altruesis, if that sounds like a weird word, it's a creation stories from Mesopotamia. So if you're looking at the map of Israel, Israel's here. It's from this region. And in that, the cries of humanity incur wrath. So the noise humanity makes disturbs the God and provokes their wrath. In Exodus, it stirs God's intervention on their behalf. So taking a wider look at the worldviews, in Egypt, humans were made by accident. They got loud. Ra tried to kill them. Isis, the female deity, because it's usually the motherly deity of the pantheons that saved the children from the father's wrath. Same thing in altruesis. Actually, a warrior saves humanity, but your main chief father figure gets really annoyed by humans and says, "You're actually messing up my sleep," is the way the story goes. "I'm going to come kill you." Same thing with Greek. Within the Greek mythologies, Zeus, again the father figure, gets mad at the creation of humans and seeks to destroy them, but some of the other gods go, "No, wait, they're useful." This is one of the only stories in the ancient societies that your chief deity, the father figure, the one who brings all things into being, hears the obnoxious cries of people and says, "They're in pain, I need to go. Not to hurt, but to rescue. Not to bring pain, but because they need me." So that sets us up for verses 1 through 10, where God interrupts Moses and insists upon him. Because a long time after the event which exiled Moses, we find Moses with a wife and son looking after his future inheritance by tending Jethro's flock. He's not just doing a 9-to-5 on this one. This is how he's going to live and stay a rich man. It's said to be decades after. So Israelite suffering is a distant memory of a forgotten time. God as projectile is the burning bush. When God saw, he turned. God called Moses, and it's actually a shout to get his attention. And as John Caputo says, the name of God is a projectile coming right at us. To speak of the insistence of God is to say that God is a problem, a provocation, an insistent disturbance, a solicitation, a visitation by a stranger. Like a call calling I know not what. An insistent knock at our door in the middle of the night, because we are the people of God, the ones assigned or singled out to respond to what is being called for in the name of God. So when Moses meets God as projectile, hears that I am the God of your father, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it's as projectile because he is comfortable. He has two kids. He actually has a future estate. And he says, "You have to go back." And so we see God as the unexpected stranger in verses 5-6, the one saying, "You have not known me." Because we don't know anything. Sometimes we'll read into the text and say, well, here's the things Moses must have known about the Jewish tradition. We have no idea. It's not mentioned. What we know is that he had a wet nurse that was his mom, and then he went to the royal courts of Pharaoh and was probably raised within Egyptian mythologies and religions. God called unexpectedly, interrupted Moses' future, and introduced God's self as the one who has been with his ancestors. The promised event of your own land is upon you, yet it comes with a threat of Pharaoh. So 23-25 and 3:8-10 move from the narrator's voice to develop God's answer from God's own voice. And so at the first section, you hear a cry rose. When God answered Moses, he said, "The cry had reached me." In the first one, it uses zakar, which usually gets translated as remember, but it can also be because he mentions the people he had the covenant with. He hears the cry of the people he'd made a promise to, and he starts remembering the promise, remembering the people. So it's more like thinking, going, how's it come to this? But it also gives an idea that it was outside of God's mind at the time. Whatever it is for the God within Exodus, he's taking care of world affairs, and he's reminded of the people crying out. So it says God looked, and at the end, God had seen. God came down, now God sends. And with that, God, in search of humanity, is divine intent seeking human agency. I have come down to rescue. I will send you, and you shall free my people. Which is amazing to me, because in one of the most dramatic scenes within our text tradition, the one where God shows up the most mind-blowingly with the pillars of fire, the plagues, the striking, the cloud on the mountain, is the one time I'd expect God to act on God's own behalf. But in this one, God calls Moses and says, I have something to do for the people. Are you with me? I have something to do. I need an agent to go forward. Because it says from God's own voice, you will free my people. It didn't say, I'm going to free. It said, I've come to rescue. You need to do it. Which puts a huge onus on the move of Moses. Because with Moses, notice, Moses was raised outside of slavery. Moses was in luxury, privilege. He saw pain, but it was never his pain. He witnessed poverty while he sat at the most luxurious table in the city. And God said, you don't know, you don't have to experience their pain to be my agent for their rescue. And so this is going to bring us to the time of rifting. Point one, if you're following along on the notes on the back and you've been wondering when these things will come up, now's the time to fill in the blank will be. So in point one, God answers your cry by sending humanity. So as we see, when it says God heard, it came up, it uses the term Shema. I only bring up the Hebrew in this because words have nuancing. Now, when I say I heard you, that could mean I just know what you said. I can repeat it back. But Shema carries a connotation of obedience. So if I say Shema, it's not that I know your words. I'm going to respond to what you said and do something about it. It's more like when your mom, for the 20th time, says, did you hear me? To say, yes, I know what you asked me to do, does not really mean, did you hear me? This is the point, the verb going towards God. It said, I heard you, I'm called by you, I'm moving towards. In these moments, the thing that's calling to him is the pain, the anguish, the cry. And I would say for us in the rifting, that often our pain, our anguish, and our crying, the dark emotions can cause us to pull into ourselves, to separate from humanity rather than moving towards it. And I would say if you're waiting for a divine act, in the same way when we've been talking about the needs of the community today, when talking about the financial state, sometimes we sit and we say, you know, it'd be great. Someone's going to walk through and say, God called me to come here. Monies. It comes from the people because God uses agents to move from the need of the people. It's us to move. If we're waiting for someone always to magically come through the door or to lift up a chair and said, who would have thought, winning lotto ticket, it might not be the best strategy because here, God's hand is in another human's. We move towards each other. So Moses raised in power, the one who knew no oppression, is the one who acts. So I'd say this reminds us that God works through us and you do not need to experience the pain of the people you advocate for. That's why you can hear the voice of the marginalized. That's why you can look to other people in the community and say, I don't know your pain, but I can be with you in it. I don't know your need, but I know you, which is the thrust of Exodus. In point two, allow your experience to shape your vision for the community. We're not just a product of the environments we were raised. We get to shape. But we do shape from our experience because as Moses experienced the God in the burning bush who said, I've been with your ancestors, I'll now be with you, he moved towards liberating a people. However, when we go to chapter 22, we get to see something. Because remember, Exodus is not about the individual, it's about the forming of a people. And so the same verb, saik, is used in 22. The cry from the powerless comes back to us when God is instructing Israel about what he expects of his new people. He expects us to learn. If you've been hurt by the church, if you've been abused by power, if you've had bad relationship, you're not supposed to reproduce that narrative. We're supposed to learn so the community we build is driven from our experience to more beautiful reality. So in 22, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. If you do, you mistreat them. I will heed their outcry as soon as they cry out to me, and my anger shall blaze forth, and I'll put you to the sword. Your own wife will become widows and your children orphans. Now that sounds radical, but just to let you know, because it's not the classes we use, when you hear things of widows, orphans, and the stranger, they're the landless society. They have no inheritance because they have no inherited right from their fathers to get the land of Israel. It's your most marginalized, your most vulnerables. If you want to see who would be equivalent to now, I'd encourage you to look at suicide rates. Look at the ones who have so little hope that they say opting out of life is better than opting in. And you'll find that it's usually minority groups who are not seen in the whole. They don't see themselves as having an inheritance in our society. And it says God will hear their cries like he heard yours. And so this is a promise and a threat. The community they were to set up by decree of God was one which heeded the outcry of the marginalized rather than one that adds to the brick quota. Because often what we do to people who don't have the voice of our own, because if you're sitting from within the group that has inheritance and you hear the cry from outside the group, sometimes I can say this is the way I've heard it. If they would have worked harder, it'd be okay. If they would have just built more bricks, that'd be all right. Our voice can overshadow the marginalized. Our voice can easily engulf the widow and the orphan because they don't have the social affluence and power to speak for themselves. So when you ignore them, you kill them. We must allow the outside voice to critique, to call truth to us. Because as we move forward to say our experience informs where we're going, if we only listen to ourselves, as one pastor said, if you only read the books that you write, your truth will be jaded. And we want to become a people, like the people of Exodus, who hear the voice of the powerless and say, we will become a group that is allowed to be critiqued by you, but that only works if we learn how to shema, how to hear their outcry and react to them. If they don't, they will become Egypt. If we don't hear that way, the way this narrative goes in 22, notice, he said, I heard your cry like when you were strangers in Egypt. If I hear the cry of people against you in the same way, you're becoming like Egypt, demanding bricks and not presence, valuing economic growth over personal health. The threat holds an implied demand. The powerless in your culture must be heard, or I will hear them, because you will never know you've mistreated or missed someone unless they have a voice. Which brings us to the last point. How we listen to the powerless. How we listen demonstrates whether we are becoming like Pharaoh or like God as a people. So Exodus 22:23 says, I will heed their outcry as soon as they cry out to me. Stepping a little beyond Exodus, which focuses on social reform, I found this to be true in every relationship. Because often we don't understand that what's being critiqued here is power systems. Within systems of power, what is done there is who has a right to speak? Who can define reality? Who can say what is? Who can voice their own pain? I say, Brittany and I go to marriage counseling, largely because I'm a pain. And so in that, we get to sit with someone who helps us understand power systems. Because it's not that we don't love each other, it's not that we don't support each other, but through our own experience, our own building of bricks, we miss what each other say. To the point that we had one impassioned discussion. And the counselor is like, wow, which one of you wants to leave the room? And we're like, why? We're doing so good. She's like, because you guys don't need each other in the room. You're demanding your brick quota, you're demanding yours. And you do this. Because for the power system, both of us said, if you only did this, if you only did this. Well, then if you only did that. And it turned into a pile that would eclipse the pyramids. When what we should have been able to do and what we got to move towards was hearing the cry of the pain of the other person to define the reality. Because when we just gather bricks and we demand of the other person, the same in this community, we say, you know what, I would do something with the church if you did this over here. I would be around these people if they just proved to me these three things. Then we're joining the side of Pharaoh. Because God calls us to hear the cry of the people. Just like in our counseling experience, Brittany and I both had to get pulled back because of the counselor's voice and say, listen to the cry of each other. You're just expressing need. If you don't hear each other's need, you'll never flourish the way you can. And it's like I said, it's not because our relationship's so bad. We're actually pretty cool. But it's because more life can be, more prosperity, more life-giving and support can be. And because of that reality, we unlearn some of the ways that we've counted bricks in order that we can learn how to lean into the other person's story. But that only exists if we're able to pause and lean in. This experience had led me to start asking, how many bricks have to be made before I can listen and respond? This does not excuse abusive actions, so I'd like to do a trigger warning. If you are in a terrible relationship of physical and verbal abuse, if you have a person that's always hurting, demeaning, maligning, notice the person who has to change is the one in the Pharaoh position, the one in the power position. At no point did it say, slaves and servants, if only you were nicer to Pharaoh, he would be cool. It's towards the power position. So if you're in a place that is abused, this is a question for Pharaoh, not slaves, the one with the power, not the one without. But in most of our relationships here, this isn't an abuse question. It's a question of posture. Are you able to hear other people? And so I would ask you, within this community, and you can come up if you like, within this community, within your personal relationships and where we're hoping to go together, are you counting bricks and raising quotas before listening? If so, how do you sit in a posture to let the other person's voice help define the reality?